Hello, welcome to the Inquire Mind podcast with me, Stanley Goldberg. Today, I'll be speaking with Norman Ohler. Mr. Ohler is a German New York Times bestselling author, novelist, and screenwriter, best known for his book, Blitzed, Drugs in Nazi Germany, which we discuss a lot today, and it has been published and translated to over 30 languages. Most recently, he's the author of The Bohemians, The Lovers Who Led Germany's Resistance Against the Nazis. On this podcast, we discuss all sorts of topics, including the fascinating story of Hitler's doctor, Theodor Moral, why deregulation of drugs universally could be a good idea, the kinds of drug experiments conducted on prisoners of war and on prisoners in concentration camps, the hypocrisy of drug use and Nazi ideology, as well as numerous other topics. As always, if you find this podcast interesting, please consider subscribing wherever you listen to the audio version, and also consider following and subscribing on YouTube, where you can also watch the video version of the podcast. And now, without further delay, I bring you my conversation with Norman Ohler. Norman Ohler, welcome to the Inquiring Mind podcast. So before we get started, I wanted to talk to you about your book that I have here, Blitzed, and your new book, The Bohemians. But before we do, can you tell the audience a little bit about yourself?
I'm a writer. I live in Berlin. I published 6 books, translated into 30 languages, and working on the 7th now.
Great. That's a very brief overview, that probably the shortest I've ever gotten. So that's good. Obviously, I really enjoyed your book, Blitzed. And it was one of those books where when you read it, you go, I can't believe it wasn't written before. But that's a testament to you actually, you know, looking it up and getting interested in it and writing about it. But how did you first decide to write this book? And so what's the story behind the book, really?
Well, I was approached by a friend of mine who said that, a DJ actually from Berlin, who said that Nazis took a lot of drugs, which seemed crazy and unfounded and just a druggy idea in a way, because I'd never heard of it. But doing a bit of research online, I thought that maybe he's right, maybe there's something interesting in it. But then actually what changed was going to the archives and finding lots of documents referring to massive drug abuse by the army and by Hitler himself. So I thought it's quite interesting, and I started, you know, doing a proper academic research, looking at it from all angles.
Right. And you're not a historian by training. So did that help you in approaching this book? Did you feel like you could tell a better story because of the fact that you're not, you know, an academic type, so you wouldn't make the story boring? Did your fiction writing come in handy?
I think so. I mean, you have to understand how research works, but you don't need to be a historian actually to understand how it works. So a little bit of academic training, I guess, which I had, came in handy. But I think the book really is successful because it is written by a novelist with a novelistic style. So I try to combine academic research with a fluid writing style, which I think is the best combination for this type of book. Also, I had made experiences with drugs, so I kind of knew what I was talking about, and probably most historians don't have that range of experiences.
And what was your experience with drugs prior? Did you study them, or, you know?
No, I just took them. Well, I mean, as a novelist, you're allowed, you know, I mean, basically no one's allowed to take drugs, but it's okay to take drugs if you're a writer. It's not like you're, it's not like as a politician, it's not okay. As a sports star, it's not okay. But as a writer, you can actually, no one would say that your book is not valid because you took drugs writing it. In fact, a lot of books that we admire have been written under the influence of drugs by the greatest writers. The question really that is interesting is what drugs would anyone take, or what drugs are good or what drugs are bad? So, or what drugs, I mean, in this case, actually, that the good drugs for me were the drugs that I would also write about. So if I write about amphetamines, I think it helps to have taken amphetamines. And I'm not saying amphetamines are good. I actually would say that they are quite unhealthy and bad. But to try them once in a while as a writer, I think it's fine. Like Philip K. Dick used amphetamines to write great works. While other people might fail using drugs and just ruin their life and not write, you know. But for me, it was important actually to test some of these drugs sometimes. Even though when I researched Hitler's drug abuse, I realized that I would not be able to test all the drugs that he was using, because that would really be damaging to my health. So I had to also rely on research and on reports that others had made using those drugs. But at one point I found out that he was using quite a few opioids, and I'd never taken opioids, and I never do take opioids, but I spoke to people who have taken them. And by having taken other drugs like amphetamines or MDMA or LSD, I can somehow relate to the drug experience. So I can understand how someone might feel who uses opioids heavily, like Hitler did.
Out of pure curiosity, how does it enhance or maybe not enhance your writing on a day-to-day basis? Like if you just mentioned Philip K. Dick took amphetamines, did it enhance your writing experience? How is that process like?
For example, on amphetamines, let's say you have an 8-hour time slot for writing. If you write sober, maybe you will be able to finish 2 pages. If you write on amphetamines, maybe you'll write 8 pages, but it's not guaranteed that those 8 pages are on the same qualities or on the same standard. Or so you have to actually double check it. You have to edit it sober. It's why Timothy Leary once said, if you write stoned, you have to edit sober. If you write sober, you should edit stoned. And I think it kind of makes sense. So the thing with amphetamines is you do more, but you feel quite good doing it. So you're not as critical while you do it. You think it's great because you feel great, but it's not necessarily great. So you have to be careful. So amphetamines would be good, I guess, for someone. I don't know. I mean, writing is very subtle. It's a subtle process, and amphetamines kill that subtleness, that subtlety. That's why I wouldn't use amphetamines every day, because it would, you know, it would not be good for my writing. I don't know how it was with Philip K. Dick. Apparently he took it every day. Every person is different, so every person has to find out whether drugs are good or bad for him or herself. For me, in general, amphetamines are too unhealthy, so I usually don't take them. But I took them maybe 3 times while I was writing Blitz, just to understand that manic rush in the brain and what happens. And so I think it was beneficial for me, not for my body, but for the book, it was good. For the readers, it was good that I took drugs once in a while.
I would imagine so. Why was...
For the readers, basically.
Yeah. What surprised me the most in your book and your research is how popular crystal meth was in Germany, I think before the war and then during the war. I think you give a... I think it's... I can't remember where it is in your book, but there's an advertisement for chocolate with... induced with crystal meth. Why was it so popular? Did people not know the health repercussions of taking crystal meth? And why was it so popular going into the Second World War?
Well, I think firstly we have to understand that the anti-crystal meth propaganda waged by the war on drugs might be exaggerated. We have to understand also that, and I'm not saying crystal meth is healthy, but I think it might be exaggerated because the war on drugs uses a lot of unrealistic claims against drugs. So we have to actually check how unhealthy is crystal meth. Crystal meth has certainly a problem because it's fabricated in illegal labs across the world and no one controls these labs. So the consumer doesn't know what's inside the crystal meth that he or she consumes. This was very different in Germany because crystal meth was legal. Also, it wasn't called crystal meth, it was just called methamphetamine. And it was made by the Temla factory in Berlin. So it had a, you know, just like any pharmaceutical product, it had, you know, quality checks, whatever. And it was taken orally, 3 milligrams a pill. I think nowadays crystal meth is usually used by snorting. So I guess a much higher dosage reaches the brain much quicker. Maybe it's similar to the difference between smoking crack and taking powdered cocaine. Smoking crack apparently is much more unhealthy because it's, you know, immediately in your brain on a higher level. So different chemical reactions happen. So I think from smoking and from snorting an illegally produced line of crystal meth today to swallowing a pill that was fabricated under controlled circumstances with 3 milligrams back in the days, there's a big difference. So I think it wasn't so unhealthy as it is today. And then again, it was addictive because methamphetamine, it makes you addicted to it, or you want to take more of it. So it was unhealthy, but because it makes you addicted to it, and it, you know, it messes with your brain basically because too many neurotransmitters are released too quickly. So then the brain has to reproduce them. That's actually a hard job for the brain. You get depressed. So it's a very problematic substance. I lost my point. Your question was why didn't people know it was unhealthy? Well, it just came out onto the market. And in the beginning, the universities in Germany wrote about the positive effects of methamphetamine, which they thought at the time were positive effects, which, for example, were you don't need to sleep as much anymore. And it raises your energy level and it increases your mood. It's mood enhancing. So, and this is all, it reduces your fear. If you're on methamphetamine, you're not afraid. At that moment when the high comes on. So they looked at it from a very different standpoint. For soldiers, it was ideal because you can operate longer. You're not afraid. You're not inhibited. You're ready to kill. So for the German army, this was a very positive drug. They didn't think it was, you know, negative in any way. Only later, they found out that it makes you addicted and that it makes you depressed. But this took like a few years actually to find out, and this was in the middle of the war. So they didn't really care about negative side effects as much as we do today. They were just seeing it as a helpful tool to enhance the fighting capability of a soldier.
Yeah, one of the things that was very evident to me when reading your book was the contradiction in the Nazi ideology. I mean, there's definitely more than one, but they preached this kind of purity in their ideology, whether it be, you know, getting rid of the Jews or, you know, not taking drugs or of any kind. Yet that's something that was very prevalent in the Third Reich. How did they make sense of that? Even though they didn't preach it necessarily, they still took drugs.
I mean, this contradiction was one of the fun factors of writing the book, because it's always fun to expose the hypocrisy of the Nazis. And this is obviously a big one. And the system itself realized that contradiction at one point. There was a guy called Leo Conti. He was the so-called health führer. Today he would be called the Secretary of Health. So in the Nazi regime, he was the health leader. And he said exactly what you said. He said, this is against our ideology of purity, and we don't need to, basically he said, we don't need this. We're stronger anyhow because we're Aryans. So we're stronger human beings than inferior races. But this is basically not true. I mean, they were not stronger because they are as inferior as any race. The Germans are. So in order to be superior on the battlefield, for example, they actually did need stimulants. So in reality, the real existing effects of methamphetamine were more powerful or more convincing to the head of command of the army than the Nazi ideology. Also, we have to understand that the army was not a party organization. The army was the army of Germany. Of course, many heads and commanders within the army were Nazis, but the army, as a body, the army was a neutral, you know, was the defense or not the military forces. So they didn't have to, you know, listen to the party ideology when it came to this. Mm.
And I know this is a very kind of difficult question, and it's a little bit of a connecting the dots going backwards in history and playing what if. But do you think that the war would have gone differently for the Germans had it not been for the drugs?
Well, I studied very closely the campaign against France, and the strategy was very interesting because it was very different from the First World War. It was a strategy that was based on speed. I mean, speed in the sense of moving very fast. Strategy only worked if Germany would reach the French border through Belgium within 3 days and three nights. And this only was possible because for 3 days and three nights, there was no stopping and no sleep, basically. I think it would have been impossible without methamphetamine. And then the Blitzkrieg, as we know it, would not have happened. It would have been a very different confrontation, military confrontation between Germany, France, and Britain. And probably wouldn't have been so easy for Germany to win this confrontation, this first big confrontation against the West. And of course, this would have completely altered the ongoings of the war, but war is such a complex, this war was so complex that it's very hard to say would the war have been shorter or longer. I don't have any interest in speculation for this, but it would have been different for sure, quite different. But how different, I don't know. Mm-hmm. I think Germany would have lost in the end because they were just not able to win, because economically and militarily they're, I mean, if Hitler wouldn't have attacked the Soviet Union, there's so many ifs, you know, if he wouldn't have attacked the Soviet Union, maybe they could have won a limited war just within Europe, the continent of Europe. So Hitler made many mistakes, but they couldn't have won against the whole world. That was a pipe dream anyhow.
Yeah.
They would never have won against the United States, for example.
Yeah. One of the very interesting stories you tell is the story of Hitler's doctor. Would you mind sharing his story? So the impact he had on Hitler, the odd experiments he kind of ran on Hitler without Hitler really understanding that this was all kind of poisoning him at the end. But, and what's the significance of these findings?
It's a very complex topic, and I dedicate like over 100 pages in the book to it. But to summarize it briefly is to state that to look at this personal physician, Theo Morales' name, gives you a very good picture of what was actually going on in the inner circle of the Nazi regime, because he was very close to Hitler from 36 to 45. For 9 years, he was basically the closest person to Hitler there was, meeting with him every day and actually injecting him almost every day. Morel believed in giving injections more than giving pills or whatever. So it's kind of interesting to see what was in those injections. And I studied the papers of Morel that are stored in the Federal Archives of Germany, and saw that from 1936 to 41, he was mostly focused on vitamins. He was a believer in vitamins. He was actually one of the first doctors in the world that understood that vitamins are important for the body. So he gave Hitler very powerful vitamin shots, and they actually worked. I mean, Hitler was not ill at all during those first 5 years. But then he did contract the Russian flu in the campaign against the Soviet Union, and for the first time received an opioid to get him out of the bed and into the briefing room. And Hitler really enjoyed that opioid because it made him euphoric, it gave him strength, and it cured the flu. I mean, flu can be quite a severe disease, and this opioid shot just kind of, the flu just vanished within minutes, you know, and he could walk, go up and go to the meeting room and continue to be the dictator and make decisive calls for how the campaign would go. So he, from that moment on, demanded stronger medications than vitamins. So it's actually not that Morel, in a way, poisoned him, but that Hitler decided on those strong medications and Morel complied, or he didn't say no to Hitler's demands, because he was afraid that you know, Hitler wouldn't like him anymore. So they became a very odd couple, very odd friendship. Became dependent on each other, basically. And there are phases when Morel would give him oxycodone, which was trademarked as Eucodol at the time, every other day in very high dosages intravenously. And for sure, Hitler was addicted to these very strong opioids and made more and more bad decisions, basically, because he was removing himself from reality. So he was not rationally deciding on military moves after 43. He was basically living in a fantasy world, and that had disastrous consequences for the German war effort. So that whole Morel Hitler story is quite fascinating and interesting, actually. Mm.
And what happened to the Morel after the war?
He was fired by Hitler a few days before Hitler committed suicide, and because he didn't have drugs anymore in the bunker, so he became useless. And he flew to Bavaria. He had a small research lab in Bavaria where he tried to research penicillin, which was also a new drug at the time. And he was found in May 1945, mid-May, I think May 17th, by a woman called Tanya Long, which was a reporter for the New York Times. She was, you know, roaming Bavaria on the hunting crazy Nazi stories, and she actually found Morel. She wrote a story about him in the New York Times. And after that story appeared, US military police got also interested in him and arrested him. And then he was interrogated for about 2 years by US military intelligence. And after those 2 years, he was pretty ill. He had heart problems, and he died shortly after the Americans released him in a hospital in Bavaria. So he, in a way, he never recovered from being fired by Hitler. He just, from that moment on, it just went downhill.
Mm-hmm.
But he lived another 2 years, but he lost everything. He lost his fortune. He had become very rich while he was personal physician of Hitler, because he was producing also pharmaceutical medicines, remedies for Hitler, and the whole morale story is totally crazy.
Obviously, in future wars, for example, the Americans, I think, used speed in Vietnam, and I forgot what else they used in Korea, and other armies have used drugs on their soldiers and gave it to their soldiers. How are the Nazis different? Obviously, they were, I think, the first to do it on a mass scale. But what can we learn? What did the Nazi effort teach us? And how are the Nazis different?
Well, they were the pioneers. They had the idea. There was one professor working for the army who had the idea to give them synthetic stimulants on a massive scale. So they proved to the world that this could help an army, give an army an advantage over the enemy. So they set a very bad example, or they set an efficient example that was then copied by the United States Armed Forces and other armies, and also terrorists. They found speed pills after terrorist attacks in terrorist apartments. So, yeah, I mean, you know, the people interested in war and killing, they learned from the Nazis to use and utilize amphetamines. What do we learn about, what do we, the non-killing people, learn about this? I think we should learn that it can be dangerous if the usage and abuse of drugs is defined and controlled by governments, like it is today, actually. Basically, I mean, the Nazis, in a way, invented the war on drugs. The war on drugs basically means that the government decides who gets the drugs and who is not allowed to get the drugs, and who gets the profit and who doesn't get the profit. And so this war on drugs can be, you know, easily manipulated to the goals that a particular government might have. So I think if we see ourselves as a democracy, which the Western countries still are in a way, and if we try to improve our democracies, I think we should also talk about deregulation of drug use and actually spreading information about drugs. That's why I was talking about the misinformation that often is associated with the war on drugs. I think the war on drugs has to stop. It's not actually a war on drugs. It's a war on minorities. It's a war on people, basically. And I think we can learn that this Nazi evil, the war on drugs, should stop.
There are a lot of people out there that advocate for full deregulation. I think there's some countries have done it. I think Portugal is one of those countries that have fully deregulated drugs. Do you mean like fully deregulating all drugs? Doesn't matter what it is. I think I'm more on that boat than most people, because if people are going to do it, might as well do it safely instead of getting it laced from some dealer that, you know.
Yeah, also, I think there's only advantages in deregulation. I don't see any disadvantages. I don't think the drug use would go up. I think the drug deaths would go down. I think the government would make more money with taxes. I think the black market would dry up and mafia structures would dry up. So I don't really see a benefit in the war on drugs. I think it would be good to deregulate everything. Question is, how do you deregulate it? Do you deregulate it from one day to the next, or do you have, you know, a step-by-step, you know, process that is overseen by the world's by the United Nations, for example. I mean, right now in the pandemic, all the countries are somehow exchanging information and working together. And I think a similar approach would have to be done to end the global war on drugs. There has to be a lot of information for people, you know, why is hemp or cannabis more dangerous than alcohol, or is it not? Or do we talk about it in schools? Should drug education be part of health education? So this has to be, this is a very big job that societies would have to do in a responsible manner, but the goal should be the deregulation. But that would be really a like kind of a revolution, global revolution. Also, the prisons are full with people who took drugs or who sold drugs. Obviously, these people would have to be released, or at least, you know, their sentences should be looked at. So it would really change. It would really change the world, and I hope that this will happen.
Yeah, is the situation in Germany's? Is the situation similar in Germany than it is in the United States?
It's not as bad in Germany. We don't have so many prisoners, and we don't enforce it as harsh as the United States. We never had a narcotics guy called Anslinger. I don't know if you know Anslinger. He was the guy who basically invented the prohibition and invented the prohibition against cannabis and all the other drugs. He was working under five U.S. presidents. And his regulations are still, you know, in force in the United States. And then you had someone like Ronald Reagan, who was very putting very stiff sentence, you know, harsh regulations into place. And then once they're in place, they're usually not, you know, taken away again. Even if you have a president that's more liberal, those things kind of stick. And we never had these like really hardcore drug hating politicians in Germany as you had in the United States. So the situation is not as bad, but I think every country in the United Nations has to sign these certain drug, you know, policies. Otherwise you get, you know, economic sanctions and all that. So it's a global problem, but I think the United States is one of the worst countries, even though in the US we now see the legalization of cannabis and some psychedelic substances in some states. So maybe the US will be the avant-garde to also lead us out of the war that the US basically imported from Nazi Germany. And this is really something that we should all, you know, get rid of. The stupid Nazi war on drugs that was basically a way to manipulate and punish people.
Yeah. In the United States, I think that the biggest hurdle to this is the fact that we have a state-by-state regulation. So New York, where I am, could be more lax with drug offenses than, say, I don't know, Oklahoma or Iowa. You know, is that the same in Germany? Is it like province by province, or
no? It's federal.
Federal
drug policies are federal. Our states don't have that much power as the United States. The states there.
Yeah. One of the interesting points, again, when the war ended, what kind of effects did the soldiers feel? Did they have extreme withdrawal after the war, or was it, you know, just life just carries on?
I didn't research this because my book kind of ends when the war ends. But what I've learned so far is that the meth problem kind of lingered on in the 50s. People still used it, but there wasn't so many supplies there anymore because the Temla company was damaged in the war. And if there's no drugs, you know, you can't really take them. So, and surveys done, or there's no statistics on people that have become addicted. So there's no, I don't know if like these 5 million German soldiers, I don't know that all that took methamphetamine, I don't know if they all suffered from, you know, withdrawal when they didn't have it anymore. I hear personal stories from people. Yeah, we still took it, or my parents gave me this. Like, I had a partner once, and her mother would receive it for breakfast when she had an exam from her parents because they just thought it's normal. Because also Pervitin was not, you know, if you took Pervitin, which was the brand name in Nazi Germany, it wasn't like, you know, snorting a line of crystal meth. It was just, you know, taking an aspirin, or you take a Pervitin. So it wasn't stigmatized. So also in the 50s, it wasn't stigmatized a big deal. So if it was around, people still used it. I think that ended basically in the 60s when other drugs became popular, like cannabis or LSD. And then crystal meth at one point came back in the, you know, 10 years ago or something like that.
Yeah. And obviously you go in detail in your book about Nazi experimentation of drugs in on prisoners in concentration camps. Mm-hmm. And obviously a lot of people know about the many horrors of the concentration camps, but what were some experiments conducted on prisoners to test out drugs and their effects?
Well, there's basically two types of experiments. One is when they tried to find better drug, a better stimulant than methamphetamine, so something that keeps you awake for a week, because they wanted a drug for the mini submarines that Germany developed, where the soldiers had to stay awake up to 7 days and seven nights without sleeping because they were alone in these mini submarines. And sleeping would have caused, you know, instant death basically, because it would have, you know, not navigated, wouldn't be able to navigate anymore. So they used prisoners in the concentration camp of Sachsenhausen, north of Berlin, and gave them combinations of stimulants like cocaine, methamphetamine, to find out what is the most potent drug combination. And the second type of drug experiments they did was in the concentration camp of Dachau, south of Munich, or is it north of Munich? Close to Munich, anyway. Where they gave prisoners psychedelic drugs like mescaline in order to develop interrogation techniques. This was very late in the war, and they didn't come to a conclusive finding.
Mm-hmm. Just on a personal note, what did you find the most shocking, most interesting when you did your research on the book? If there's more than one, feel free to name a few, but was there something where you were like, wow, I didn't see that one coming?
Well, the whole book had this wow effect on me, or the whole research, when every corner I turned was to me totally incredible and amazing and mind-blowing. I really enjoyed reading the notes of Morell, Hitler's doctor, because these notes are, you know, very interesting, original, and unique. And you feel like the famous fly on the wall, and that fly was actually like landing on Hitler's forehead, basically. And you could like sit there and listen to what they would discuss and what crazy drugs they would use now, because Hitler had these important decisions to make, and he felt kind of bad. And then how they talk about other politicians, and you know, it's kind of gossipy in a way, but it's also hardcore factual. So that was really juicy, and I really enjoyed writing those passages, because they're all true, but they sound completely unbelievable.
Yeah. Did you always envision yourself maybe writing a book about the Third Reich, something about the Third Reich, or did you not see it coming?
No, I always wanted to write a book about the Third Reich because it's my history. And at the same time, it's the most interesting, you know, 9 years, at least of the 20th century. I think it's fascinating, and we can actually learn quite a lot from it. And it's full of drama and horror, but also interesting, funny, not funny, but Well, I mean, it is kind of funny, actually. Some of the drug details are, you know, darkly funny. So I really enjoyed to write about this period from this angle, because usually this period is very bleak, and to write about the drug use is not bleak. It's totally colorful. So in a way, it was fun to write about it, even though it was quite dark at times. And if you read the book, I think also it feels funny sometimes, but it also feels very serious, and I kind of like that combination. Mm-hmm.
Obviously, I mentioned early in the podcast that you have a new book out. I think it came out in March over here, mm-hmm. Called The Bohemians. Unfortunately, I have not had the chance to read it, but can you tell the audience what the book is about, why you decided to write it, and, well, sort of not an elevator pitch, but why should people go out and buy it?
Well, I was interested in how actually life was in Berlin at the time, to get away from the political facts and the politicians and get into the lives of the people. How did it feel to live in a extremely beautiful and interesting metropolis when suddenly a dictatorship comes along and starts to radically change your life, and suddenly the Jews are outlawed, and, you know, if you make a joke about Hitler, you end up in a concentration camp. I mean, this is all totally insane, you know. 5 years ago, you could do anything you wanted, and or 5 minutes ago, you could do anything you wanted, and suddenly you can't anymore. And I found a resistance network that existed, and that is not so known in Germany even. And it was led by a couple, Haro and Libertas were their first names, and they were gathering friends around them, trying to figure out what they could do against the dictatorship. And they did quite a lot, actually. And they did a lot over several years, and it grew into a network of over 100 people. Very different people, artists, that's why it's called the Bohemians, but also workers or teachers or students who are part of it. And they try to undermine the fascist society here in Berlin by being different and by, you know, living differently. And I think the book's great because it really gives you a very intimate and detailed feeling for how it was to live in Berlin from 1933 to 1942. This is when the book ends. So I can actually recommend you to read it.
And how did you come across this research, this movement? I'm sorry. Was there another DJ friend that told you about it?
No, I was sitting in an archive in Munich researching for Blitz when I found a letter from Haro to his father. And the letter was so interesting, even though Haro had nothing to do with drugs, but he was working for Göring, who had a lot to do with drugs. That's why I came across Haro, but it was a coincidence. But he talked to his father in this letter about resistance, and that he thought everything he had done was right, that he was ready to, you know, bear the consequences for his dangerous life. And I'm always interested in dangerous, you know, lives, or in resistance, or in, you know, going against the grain. So I started to research more about him, and the more I learned about Haro and his wife, the more fascinated I was with the story, and then it just shaped itself into the next book. Mm.
And you mentioned that you have another book on the way. Can you disclose any information as to what the book is going to be about?
It's kind of a continuation of Blitz. So it actually starts in 45 and talks about that second half of the 40s and the first half of the 50s. And it examines how exactly the United States adopted the Nazi drug policies and what that actually meant for the victorious system of the United States. How did they actually change because they got in touch with Nazi ideology? How that ties into racism in America, how did that shape the drug policy in America, and you know, the effects on the American soul, basically.
Okay. So I ask, in the interest of time, I ask all my guests at the end of the podcast two questions. Feel free to answer them in any order you see fit. The first one is, if you have any, what gives you hope for the future? It could be as general or as vague as you like. And the second question is, what are five books on any topic, fiction, nonfiction, that you would recommend to people?
What gives me hope are my two kids, because they are much more intelligent than the public discourse we're experiencing right now in the pandemic. So I think with their intelligence, I have a certain hope that the future will not be bleak, but will, you know, maybe be surprising and maybe be more democratic or opening or interesting than we might imagine right now. The five books I recommend are Gravity's Rainbow by Thomas Pynchon, The Bohemians by Norman Ohler,
Selfless plug. I like it. Nice.
You want five books?
As many as you want. They don't have to be your favorite books. They could be just books you would just recommend people.
I think people should read Moby Dick by Herman Melville. And I think everyone should read like a Russian, classical Russian novel by Tolstoy. Maybe Anna Karenina. And then for good measure, maybe an African book by Chinua Achebe, like okay. Things Fall Apart.
Great. I appreciate you taking the time to speak with me today. I highly recommend this book. I look forward to your next book, and I look forward to reading your current book, which is The Bohemians. So Norman Ohler, thank you very much.
Thank you. Have a good day.
You too.